You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus from New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us on this Sunday evening. Poverty, not only here in America, but poverty globally, has been a persistent problem for decades, if not for centuries. Why do some people have less than what's needed on their plate daily, where others have so much more? Is it something about the governments of various countries? Is it poor planning? Do we not produce enough food? I suppose if we had a room full of people, we could discuss that in more detail. But any one question, any one solution may not be the whole story. And that's why I've invited my guest this week, author and educator Catherine Eden. Her new book is A Story of Poverty That Has Never Been Told. And it's an amazing book because people think, well, Jesus, in fact, the book is called The Injustice of Place. And for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Catherine about uncovering the legacy of poverty right here in America. And people think, well, there's no poverty here in America. We're a very rich country. We are to a degree, but there are many who have less than what's necessary to sustain themselves. So for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Catherine Eden about that. Catherine, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Poverty, I can honestly tell you that any given city, I'm a native of New England, even right here in Massachusetts, I driving into work on a daily basis, I see people on the streets, people live on the streets. You wonder to yourself, they're not having a warm breakfast this morning, probably not going to have a nice cup of coffee, they're not probably going to have a decent afternoon meal or an evening meal. Let me ask you first and foremost, how prevalent is poverty in this country as opposed to any other country? I mean, let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, are we below the international level, or for a country as rich as we are, we have too much poverty?
You know, in the book I wrote just before Injustice of Place called $2 a Day, we document the rise in what we call $2-a-day poverty, the proportion of American households living on less than $2 per person per day, which is one of the global measures of poverty. And we show that has been rising in the United States in the aftermath of welfare reform. But this book shifts the lens away from America's poorest people, which we describe in great narrative detail in $2 a Day, to America's poorest places. And it uses big data to identify the places where disadvantage in America is the deepest. And then it explores the legacy of those places, how those places came to be places that bestowed disadvantage onto their residents for generation after generation. And so that's really the theme of the book. And one of the inspirations of shifting our lens from people to places is that we now know from a lot of research that where you grew up is as consequential to your life chances as your behavior, your genetics, the quality of the medical care you receive, and so on. So I think as a nation, we're becoming more and more aware through research of the importance of place. But some places have been persistently among the most disadvantaged regions in the nation for decades and even centuries. And that's the story we tell in this book.
I have often heard, like you have just mentioned, that certain regions, and I'll be very specific, at least this is to what I've been told. I have nothing to go on, and perhaps you can validate whether this is true or not. But you take states like perhaps Alabama, Mississippi, parts of Louisiana. In other words, the Deep South, since the Civil War, that's an awful long time. But is it fair to say that some of those southern states, some of those regions down in the South, tend to be among the poorest?
So what we do is we construct a multidimensional index of disadvantage, not just looking at income, but also health, because poverty is cumulative. It gets under our skin, and it makes us sick, but also the rate of intergenerational mobility. And we put those three sources of data together, income, poverty, health, and intergenerational mobility, we find that America's most disadvantaged regions are indeed not the entire Deep South, but really the historic cotton and tobacco regions. So these are areas that had the highest rate of enslavement right up until the Civil War. Many of them are majority-minority today. But in addition to the historic cotton and tobacco belts, we see very, very deep disadvantage in central Appalachia. That's really eastern Kentucky and western West Virginia, parts of Tennessee. And then in South Texas, which is a region that really has been largely ignored by scholars of poverty. And in fact, in South Texas, we see some of the highest rates of income poverty that you find anywhere in the country. So we really focus on these four regions, the historic tobacco belt, kind of stretching from Virginia on down into South Carolina, the cotton belt running from the Carolinas all the way to Louisiana and Arkansas, and then central Appalachia, and then down into South Texas. And in each of these places, we embedded researchers for months who interviewed local folk, participated in community events, wove themselves into the community, so that not only were we looking at this big data, but we were also looking at the texture of daily lives. And then when the pandemic hit and we could no longer embed ourselves in these communities, we turned to history. One of, I think, the most intriguing parts of the book is the untold histories of these places, the legacies that all of these places have in highly exploitative labor practices, in highly extractive economies, organized often around a single commodity, cotton, tobacco, coal, spinach and onions in South Texas, and involving a very small cadre of haves, landowners, and a very large swath of have-nots, laborers who have few rights, miserable living conditions, and very few chances of making it into the middle class.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So, what was striking about these places, you know, they're very disparate regions of the country, was not how different they were, although you know they're different in terms of their racial and ethnic composition, but how similar they were in terms of the extreme level of extraction and exploitation, not seen to the same extent in other parts of the United States.
It's interesting because I tend to be a history buff, and I love to focus on prior to the Civil War, and then even throughout the Civil War, and then Reconstruction, and you're right. So it goes back to those, you know, those years leading up to the Civil War. As you said, cotton and tobacco were major products in the Deep South, but very few became rich because of it. Slavery and keeping people, lack of education, lack of opportunities. But Catherine, you would think here in the year 2023, we're long past all of that. Supposedly opportunities are open for everybody and anybody. But it sounds like some of the same circumstances that were afflicting people in the, you know, in the 19th century, mid-19th century, are still afflicting those same people in similar regions today. Why has there not been more progress in those parts of the country?
That's right. So these extractive industries really did not fully develop, even in the Cotton Belt, until the late 1920s and early 1930s. But they continued to hold sway until the mid-1960s. These were still cotton towns, still tobacco towns, still coal towns. Until that period, and then those industries really began to stumble. But in the aftermath of that, these exploitative economies, what we see are specific mechanisms holding these places to the disadvantage that characterized them historically. And so what we do with our embedded research, our ethnography, is we identify the mechanisms linking the past to the present. So in the book, Injustice of Place, every chapter is about a mechanism linking the past to the present. So first we find that all of these places have a tradition of very, very racially and ethnically separate and highly unequal schools that persist even today. So, for example, many Southern private schools today were segregation academies, really set up in the aftermath of Brown v. Board of Education to defy that Supreme Court mandate to integrate. So a failure to integrate schools that consigned usually black and brown children, but also white children to Appalachia, to highly unequal schools and very, very poor level of education, making it incredibly important, difficult for them to get ahead or to even attend college. Violence, a tradition of violence that begins in each of these cases with the need to suppress civil rights activity and to maintain control over labor. And these places remain among the most violent in the nation today. The Cotton Belt is as violent as Chicago. Very few people know this. Corruption. We just published an op-ed in Time Magazine talking about how each of these places for decades, if not centuries, have been characterized by the corruption of public officials who extract often federal and state dollars, lining their own pockets rather than investing in the communities that they're supposed to be serving. And, you know, many times these elites they're the descendants of the folks that controlled these regions from way back. We outlined the tragic loss of social infrastructure in these places, the bowling alleys, the beauty salons, the movie theaters, places where people come together in most communities and build social bonds. And we document how those places have been disappearing in these regions. And this leads to all kinds of deleterious outcomes, including deaths due to opioid overdose. The systemic racism embedded in federal disaster relief policy that ends up exacerbating inequality after a disaster rather than ameliorating it. So we tell the story of Marion, South Carolina, where back-to-back flooding and hurricanes ended up benefiting white homeowners, whereas black homeowners were often really stripped of their wealth in the aftermath of these back-to-back disasters. So these are the mechanisms that are holding these places to their prior legacies. Yeah.
It's almost, as I said, you go back in time and you think nothing has really changed. And I want to continue in that vein, but I do want to take a quick pause to remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. My guest this week is Princeton University faculty member and author Catherine Eden. Her new book is The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. Catherine, I can honestly say that I'm not surprised, but you hear from the federal government, from the White House on down, right through state governments, that we've seen radical changes in this country. We'll never see those times again. Opportunities abound everywhere. You just have to be willing to bootstrap, if you will, and pull yourself up. So it's made to sound, at least in the public forum, that if this is indeed true, then it's not because government or policies or mechanisms are not in place, but in reality, whatever is in place is not reaching those that desperately need it. Is it fair to say that government should be taking a bigger role in this?
So, absolutely. Place-based inequality is often the direct result of policy decisions made in prior generations to benefit the elite class. So, for example, if you look back in the history of the Cotton Belt and the Tobacco Belt, and even going down to South Texas, what we see is that the policies that really benefited the middle class after World War II and even after the Great Depression, were often restricted two people who were elite. Whites, for example, were often included and benefited from these policies, but Blacks and Hispanics were often excluded, in part because the jobs in which they worked were excluded, were categorically excluded from receipt of these benefits. So over and over again, policies meant to protect these capitalist enterprises would disinherit, really, the poorest citizens in these regions for the benefit of these extractive industries. So, you know, what policy begat, policy needs to untangle. Right now, it's an interesting time, Al, because we have unprecedented dollars, federal dollars, that could be deployed to solve these problems because of the Biden administration's recent initiatives. There's a lot of money out there to devote to regions like these. But in some ways, unless you understand the mechanisms, you can't craft the right solutions. So, for example, if we just deliver money to these places in the way we often have, they don't reach the people in greatest need. They line the pockets of the elites because of this history of deep corruption. If we don't confront these separate and highly unequal educational systems where the schools that the have-not kids attend are D and F rated, where white students are schooled in former segregation academies and other largely white private schools. If we don't confront the fact that that violence is endemic and that violence is really rooted in this lack of mobility, this inability of kids born into poverty to make it to the middle class because of inadequate schooling and, you know, trauma in the neighborhood and so on. If we don't confront those realities that are, you know, that are rooted in governmental institutions, then we're not going to see progress in these areas. You know, one of the most striking moments for us was when we mapped, you know, the index of deep disadvantage, that's our multidimensional index, and saw these very strong regional patterns. And then it dawned on us, you know, these are the same regions that gave the war on poverty its face 60 years ago.
Right.
And if we don't intervene, we're going to be looking at the same map 60 years from now.
You know, Catherine, I just keep thinking, I think many people would almost think, no, that doesn't happen anymore. As you talked about, the wealth that's held within just so many hands among certain people, and this reluctance, or this more than reluctance, there's no inspiration, there's no desire to help others, just wanting to keep the wealth, keeping the, as you talked about, better educational institutions, a better quality of life for just so many people and not for the rest. It almost seems unconscionable in this day and age. But one of the key words I couldn't help was, as you were talking, I'm thinking corruption. And people think, oh God, no, today everything is transparent. That's a lot of phooey, for lack of a better term. But in this day and age of 24/7 news cycles, I mean, it seems like almost anything anybody does becomes fodder for the, you know, for the news outlets and for social media especially. You would think by now, Catherine, that the word would have gotten out and the masses, 300 plus million people living in this country, you know, would rise up and say enough is enough. And I suppose from time to time there's been marches down in Washington, D.C. and other major cities, as I'm sure you're well aware. But this seems to be, you know, it only lasts for so long, and then the momentum seems to fall off. So what really would make a big difference in the short term?
Yeah, corruption is a tough problem to solve. I will say, since I'm talking to a journalist, that the role for journalism, I think, is huge here. Maybe especially nonprofit journalism like National Public Radio, Mississippi Today, is a nonprofit newspaper in Mississippi that unfolded one of these stories of corruption. You've probably heard about Brett Favre and the welfare scandal, almost $80 million stripped away from a program meant to help Mississippi's neediest children and put into the pockets of celebrity athletes and to build a volleyball stadium at Brett Favre's alma mater, where his daughter was playing volleyball at the time. You know, I mean, this is happening right now in 2023, this case is being adjudicated. And, you know, it took an intrepid journalist, Anna Wolf, who won a Pulitzer Prize for her coverage of the story, to really ferret this out.
Yeah.
And the level of persistence that it took for her to bring the state officials and, you know, the local nonprofits, you know, from this very region of deepest disadvantage to account was really remarkable. But, you know, I think a lot of what's going on here is magical thinking. We think we'll deliver the money and, the officials, the elected officials or the local leadership will magically solve the problem.
Yeah,
we took a road trip through 175 of the most disadvantaged places in the United States. We write about that road trip in the book. And, you know, I come from rural Minnesota, where everybody's just a little above average.
Right.
as the famous quotation goes. But what struck us about these places is the level of wealth and poverty, cheek to jowl. You know, there haven't been three classes in these places. There hasn't been a thriving middle class really ever in these places. There have been the rich and the poor, with very little in between.
Yeah.
And the rich have worked very hard to maintain, as you say, hoarding their advantages over the years, because their wealth depends on the exploitation of the poor. So,
right.
You know, like the catfish industry in central Mississippi is a great example. You know, you have a few very wealthy owners and you have people, you know, gutting and freezing fish and out on those catfish ponds. And it's brutal work. You can work at a catfish farm in central Mississippi for years and only make a little more than the minimum wage. And maybe not even earn full-time hours, and thus, you know, you're stripped of benefits.
Right.
So it's very striking how wealth and poverty are both very much present in these places, and these forms of extraction continue, as you say. Sometimes you think, well, gee, nothing ever changes, because these economies continue to extract and to rely on low-wage and poorly compensated labor. You know, one story we tell about the Cotton Belt is that these employers are always looking for more and more exploitable people. And so in the Mississippi Delta and elsewhere across the South, cotton farmers and catfish farmers are more and more turning to South Africans.
Yeah, the same way.
To bring over through the H-2A visa
yeah.
program, right? These are white Afrikaners. We know in South Africa unemployment is around 30%. When they come to the United States, there are supposed to be labor protections in place. But, of course, you hear stories, and there are many lawsuits of employers who are making these South Africans work 50, 60 hours a week. Meanwhile, they're firing their longtime black employees because, of course, it's harder to exploit citizens than non-citizens.
Exactly. It seems like a vicious, it is a vicious circle. And as you said, you look back at history and you think, you know, have we really made a lot of progress? And I suppose in the overall realm, as a global, neighbor on this planet, yes, but you know, socially, racially, and economically, you know, the United States really needs to step up to the plate. We've only got a few minutes left, so I have to ask you at the end, between the research that you did along with your co-authors, Luke Schaefer and Tim Nelson, the traveling that you did, actually going down, which I have to, you know, kudos to you, seeing it firsthand instead of just, well, you know, we looked at some data. No, you saw it firsthand.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying. What would be effective in a very short time? What's in other words? I know we talked about, you know, the haves and the have-nots. That's probably going to be around long after you and I have gone. But you know, hopefully, we can level the playing field. But what, from your research, from what you've seen, what would be a doable solution that would result in positive results in the short run?
Yeah, I think many people in these regions are really ready for change. The patterns of the past are sort of running out, and you know, people in these communities realize that if things don't change, they're sort of doomed. So there's a hunger and a thirst for new ideas. One thing I think that we could do in the near term, and that's already happening through Bidenomics and in other initiatives, is to focus on supporting the industrializing, the nascent industrializing movements in these places. So all of these places tried to move to a more mixed industrial economy after the 1960s, but these little industries were just crushed in the aftermath of NAFTA and the China boom, and many, many initiatives to try to bring economic diversity to these places could not survive in the face of foreign competition. So we do call for bringing supply chains home and really supporting the efforts of these places to attract new industry. Now, of course, in order to do that, they're going to have to clean up their act, because businesses won't move to corrupt places.
Right.
They're going to have to begin to invest in their schools, because businesses are not going to send, you know, their local leadership into a place where, if you want a decent education, you've got to send your kid to a former segregation academy.
Right.
And so, in some ways, they've got a chicken and egg problem, but certainly making it easier for American manufacturing to set up shop in these places would go a long way.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, the supporting the industries right here on our home turf. It's so dismal to hear people say, "No, move it all offshore." No, that's not the way to build an economy. It's not a way to put wealth in everybody's hands. Again, I want to thank my guest this week, author and educator Catherine Eden. The book is The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. A great read, a really thoroughly researched book that sheds light on the history of poverty, the haves and the have-nots, and how it continues to be a persistent problem here. Catherine, real quickly, we've got a few moments left. If people want to reach out to you directly, how might they do that?
Yeah, you can reach me on the Princeton website, but you can also go to theinjusticeofplace.com.
Terrific.
And you'll find us there. And you can download all the data and play with it yourself. So hopefully listeners will go to that resource and look at the data for their hometown.
Yeah, good idea. And buy the book, The Injustice of Place, widely
That's
available. I want to thank, Catherine for being with us this evening. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700, and we hope to hear from you soon. For the Public Eye, this is Elmo.